Welcome to A Conspiracy of Lemurs, a Regal House publishing podcast that celebrates the writing craft. Co-hosted by myself, Janie Royal, founder and editor-in-chief at Regal House Publishing, and the ever-marvelous Pam Van Dyke, Regal's managing editor. We are thrilled today to welcome the multi-talented J.R. Potter, the Fitzroy Books author of Thomas Creeper and the Gloomsbury Secret, to discuss writing the underdog hero in middle grade fiction. Pam, can you tell our listeners a little more about our guest today?
J.R. Potter grew up in New England and studied history at Brown University. While in college, he began writing his first story for young readers, a tale about an erudite talking dinosaur with a magical robotic briefcase. His supernatural graphic novel series, The Glimmer Society, has appeared in the pages of Image Comics, while his short fiction has been collected by The Portland Review, Owl Canyon Press, and various speculative fiction anthologies. His latest work, Thomas Creeper and the Gloomsbury Secret, which we will be talking about today, was the 2019 recipient of Fitzroy Books' Kraken Book Prize for middle grade fiction. Philip Kennedy Johnson, comic book writer of Batman, Superman, Aquaman, and Captain America, has this to say about Thomas Creeper. In Gloomsbury, creative powerhouse Jamie Potter gives us a rich and haunting alternative to Hogwarts, filled with captivating characters and enthralling mysteries. For every fan of young adventure, illustrated fiction, and all things supernatural. So welcome to you, Jamie. We're very excited to talk to you today about Thomas Creeper and the Gloomsbury Secret, which I very much enjoyed, I have to say. And on that note, I wanted to ask you to, if you would mind giving our listeners a little bit of an overview of Thomas Creeper and the Gloomsbury Secret, and tell us a little about your inspiration behind it.
Absolutely. First, I want to say how incredibly delighted and honored I am to be part of this wonderful podcast series curated by you two femme fatales of the literary firmament. For you alliteration fans out there, I'm throwing a lot of F's in there, a lot of F-bombs. So, let's get down to brass tacks. So Thomas Creeper and the Gloomsbury Secret is pretty much my love letter to everything I love about the spooky side of New England where I grew up. Grave rubbings that I would do with my master painter mother, a normal family activity for the weekend, of course. And all that stuff that's sort of the substrata that's under your feet in New England, there's always something and always a ghost story. There's always something kind of creaky around the bend. And so I would say that turning 38 this month and you start looking back on your life and looking at the real rich periods of inspiration. And I have to say, growing up in Connecticut in a small town called Riverside, that, you know, living by the tides, low tide, high tide, the moon ever present, I was sort of inherited this world that was so rich and the ocean is so strange and wonderful with all its plant life. So I had a great setting and a great background. And then my dad went to our local library, and my dad is an incredible bookworm. And also when he finds something that he knows someone else is going to like, he passes it along. Maybe they call that oversharing sometimes. Sometimes you got to hit the mute button on them, but it's all coming from the right place. And he came home with a book that changed my life. And it is actually mentioned in the dedication to Thomas Creeper. It's a book by one of my gothic heroes, John Bellairs, who resided in Haverhill, Massachusetts, a very New England sounding town. You would think it would be Haverhill or Haverhill. Nope, Haverhill. I think I'm doing that right. Just like Worcester and all those other strange names. And of course, the illustration, the frontispiece, is by the great Edward Gorey. So just imagine a 10-year-old Jamie Potter who hasn't assumed the highfalutin name of J.R. Potter, the author and illustrator yet, getting this book like a passport to a whole new world. And that's what became my model that I'm continuing to reach for, both illustrative side and writing. And I think that just touches upon all the amazing people who come into our life and send things that are important, books and records and all these things that they think we'll like. And you just never know your impact. You might be creating a wayward children's author 20 years hence. I think there's probably worse things, right?
Yes, absolutely. Jamie, I'm going to jump in for a second because you're describing this incredible town in which you grew up in. And I know we're going to get into protagonists and sidekicks and all this great stuff, but maybe if we start with the broad picture, because I'm reminded as you're speaking of Gloomsbury and how the town in which Thomas Creeper resides has such a strong, visceral character all of its own. I mean, you describe the scabberweed and the fog and the perpetual rain and even the offshore currents. I think it's Mad Marge, right? Even the offshore currents seem to be full of personality, which has an underlying, not malevolence as such, but certainly sort of a dismal feeling of almost entrapment, which is echoed, of course, by Thomas's desire to seek something beyond the horizon. And I thought, if you don't mind speaking to the role of Gloomsbury as the environment in which Thomas and Jenny are enacting this great adventure.
Certainly. I think we discussed this in a lot of the editing, Janie, about how the town itself was a character, you know, just as Hogwarts Castle is a character, right? And all the wonderful J.K. Rowling books, you have paintings that move and you have staircases that shift. Obviously, being an incredible Harry Potter fan, I actually legally share the name of his father. So it's a double blessing or curse when you're trying to like rent movies or get takeout and people ask you like, you're related to that like Harry Potter character. But Janie, you brought up this point of how the town has to kind of be a character too. And for me, that's the world building aspect, right? So I took the template of the New England that is sort of in my heart, maybe like Kafka in Exile, maybe not that lofty or grand, but often creators like Kieslowski, the incredible Polish director who created the Red, White, and Blue trilogy that's set in Poland and France. You know, it's almost like from the distance, you can view the thing better or it has a richness to it. So this process of creating Gloomsbury was for me to resurrect my childhood in some degree, but then imbue it even more with supernatural elements. And one thing that I did, not giving away all my tricks, but in making this sort of grand thoroughfare of the town called Wyland Avenue, full of these splintery boardwalks and these dangerous sinkholes under the surface, what was really amazing with naming Wyland is that, unbeknownst to me, I named it after my childhood rock star hero, the late Scott Weiland from Stone Temple Pilots. He was kind of my Jim Morrison of my era and a person whose music I still go back to. But Weiland is also the name of the novel by Charles Brockden Brown, which is considered by some to be one of the original Gothic novels, along with Anne Radcliffe, who I know Janie is also a fan of. So there was kind of a serendipity that I didn't plan in that. And I'm just so grateful that that fell into my lap.
It was buried there somewhere in the depths of your mind, I think.
Somewhere, right? Jungian something down there.
Exactly. Synchronicity. That's what I was thinking.
Now we're talking to police. This podcast is getting good.
Very radical podcast.
So in regards to the theme of the podcast and the underdog, Jamie, I wonder if you might share with us some of the characteristics of an underdog protagonist that you think are important when writing middle grade fiction and how your understanding of these attributes inspired the marvelous character of Thomas Creeper.
Well, thank you very much. I will say, so the underdog has nothing to lose, right? So there's nothing but going up. There's nothing but growth. And that's the person that across all political strata, across the varying vicissitudes of trauma, everybody at some point in their life has their back against the wall. And I think young people, more than any other group, have their back against the wall because they don't really own anything in society. They don't have power that's recognized per se. And so going back to the Bel Air's books, which inform so much of my writing, they're usually involving a young person and an elderly person, and sort of the two bookends of our society that we kind of kick to the side because, you know, either one doesn't know enough and one just can't stop prattling on about how things were so much better in their day. We sort of kicked those bookends to the side. And what's so wondrous about the Bel Air's oeuvre is that those people end up solving these massive problems that actually sometimes save the world unbeknownst to the rest of the society. So I just love the underdog because they're always reaching for something greater. They have a lot of skin in the game, but they have, to quote Bob Dylan, when you have nothing, you got nothing to lose. So I think that's what I gravitate towards, writing about the sympathetic underdog character for the sympathetic underdog reader.
So I'm also thinking that weakness is so important in the construction of a character. Weakness makes him or her vulnerable, and vulnerability is critical to driving tension. So what do you think particularly that Thomas Creeper's vulnerabilities are, Jamie? And did they kind of come naturally as you thought about the character, or did you decide, with great forethought exactly what kind of weaknesses you wanted him to have?
Weakness and strength, that dichotomy is crucial. I think when someone is open or vulnerable about their weakness, then in a way we almost respect them more, because I don't know about you, I don't feel like Superman every day when I put my jeans on, or, you know, life is so bewildering. And so I think when you take this swirling maelstrom of dread that is Gloomsbury, which is already in itself an antagonist, and then you have a 13-year-old mortician's apprentice who's around dead bodies all the time, which is not a normal, I think, affair for a huge contingent of young people. You already have that absurdity layered on that. You have a disconnect with a very overbearing father who we're perceiving, I should say, him as overbearing, but he might be the motor that's also keeping the family business going. So you can kind of glimpse that vantage point at different times in your life. It can be even more of an antagonist when you're a young person, especially a young person who doesn't want to be surrounded by corpses all the time. I think as you get older, you can sort of look back and maybe have hopefully a little bit of compassion for somebody like Elijah Creeper V. So Thomas is born into this series of events and conditions that are strangling him. Pressure, anxiety are all things that I know I dealt with as a teenager. I don't think that's gone away for young people today. And so Thomas has this in spades. But when he has this intellectual stimulation with his best friend, Jenny Myers, who just is a no BS, just let's go for it kind of person, who's a great friend to have in your camp, and who's strong and also smart and resourceful, that pressure, like the sun sighting that I describe in the book, these random, really rare occurrences that happen when Mad Marge lets up her guard and sun sneaks through and people get vitamin D and nourishment and happiness. Thomas has that sun sighting with another person his age, which I think we can all relate to, that incredible moment of having someone see you for who you are and seeing them. So sight is really important in this book. Blindness, I use fog as sort of this intermediary between the two. But if I could just continue a little bit longer on that note, I actually wanted to begin the podcast on an anecdote. And that anecdote comes from the American poet William Stafford, who wrote the epic poem about existential dilemma, Traveling Through the Dark. Any of our listeners who haven't read that poem should check it out. I think you can read it on poetry.org for free. But anyway, Stafford wrote a memoir on the craft of poetry called Writing the Australian Crawl. In the introduction, Stafford shares an anecdote from his childhood where he goes on a childhood walk with his father. And at some point in the walk, as they're going through this forest, the father turns to the young Stafford and says something to the effect of, son, there are hawks that nest up in these trees. Your eyes are sharper than mine, so there's a really good chance you're going to see them. And so that kind of encapsulates for me this idea of the young underdog with the sharper eyes and the keener hearts. They're not bogged down or jaded like so many of us adults at points in our lives. They're not comfortably numb. They have these keen eyes. And I think the more that we validate and support that vision, which Stafford's father is doing in this amazing anecdote, which kind of parallels any great mentor or teacher or librarian who's been somehow miraculously put in our path. They sort of have this generosity of spirit and no competition in the game or anything. They say, you know, you, sir or madam, you have talent. You might not see it, but I do. And I'm going to do everything I can do to support you in that exploration. And so that sort of A to Z is a little bit my philosophy and passion about writing for young readers.
That's wonderful. Yeah. And I was going to mention too, one of the most wonderful things about Thomas Creeper, there are many, many wonderful things about the novel, is that in the midst of all this gloom and all of the expectations on Thomas Creeper and all the difficulties he's dealing with in his home, he's lost a brother, all kinds of things are happening. I mean, you really have set this character up in terms of obstacles. But in light of all that, he has this wonderful sidekick you've mentioned earlier, Jenny Myers. And I wonder what your thoughts are about a middle grade novel or any novel really, where you have truly an underdog and the role of that sidekick. What does the sidekick do to keep the reader from feeling all the doom and gloom all the time?
Well, that is a phenomenal question. I would expect no less from you, Pam. I will do my best to hold up my end of the bargain and reply. I think it's the issue of foils, right? And reflective surfaces. Jenny is, on all intents and purposes, is this brilliant and beautiful girl that is out of Thomas's league. Even he says that, you know, there's no reason they would ever have been connected had they not reached for the same book at the school's, library fund drive. So it was this sort of chance encounter, which is just what life, right? We can talk about all the horrible things in life, but how many times when something good happens, you just step back and you're just so grateful. Why are you worrying about it, professor? She always calls him the professor because of his anxiety and his analysis paralysis. She's sort of like, well, let's just kick the door down. And I think all of us have certain people like that in our lives. And hopefully, when you were young, dealing with whatever family drama or, you know, the emotional tidal wave of all that you're going through as a young person, hopefully you had a person who was like, all right, let's table this, take a deep breath, and let's kick down the door. And I think that's Jenny Myers. And she's probably one of the favorite characters I've ever written because she's so smart and she's fearless. When you combine those two together, it's like the opposite of being ignorant and unintentioned. So I have a couple of selections from the J.R. Potter Private Library of Inspiration that I fear a little bit that I'm going to end up sounding like James Lipton inside the actor's studio because I'm going to be fawning over my literary heroes. But I want people who are listening to this, who are authors and writers, that you never get anywhere without help from other sources. And I actually have two small excerpts that are from, they're both first-person perspective from two very different authors that are some of my favorite writing for middle grade. So the first one comes from my favorite book. This is like reading Rainbow, J.R. Potter style. My favorite book. I came across it in the dreaded year of 2020, but it's actually from 2019. It is The Line Tender from the brilliant Kate Allen, who I do not understand why she is not a household name. I've already written her, actually even today, letting her know that I'll be part of her street team whenever in-person events start again. She wrote this book that, to me, in many respects, is almost like a catcher in the rye of our time period. Although, if you took the cynicism and sort of the loss of innocence that was wrung out of Salinger through something called, I guess, World War II, you know, that little blip, and you put back in a hopefulness and a willingness to get beyond all challenges. I think to me, that's sort of the Line Tender. But I recommend everyone who's listening to please go get this book. So I'm going to read a short passage that describes what the Line Tender is. And as you listen to me reading it, I want you to think of Line Tender in as many permutations and abstract forms. The word line, the word tender. And that's, to me, the magic of a written word. Kate Allen's The Majestic Line Tender. When a child is lost at the bottom of a quarry, every minute counts. Dad had told me this plenty of times before. The primary diver enters the water, tethered to a search line as tall as a skyscraper. The line tender holds the line above the surface. The primary diver descends through the dark and cold until he hits the bottom, stirring up a thick cloud of silt and sediment. It is so dark that even with a searchlight, nothing would be visible. Touch is the only useful sense. He gives a tug on the line to let the line tender know he has reached the bottom. The divers would hope to find the child within 60 minutes, a time span known as the golden hour. The child's heart rate slows. His blood stops flowing to his fingers and toes, his hands and feet, his arms and legs, to conserve blood for the heart and brain. Children are particularly resilient when submerged in cold water. See, that last line hits me like a freight train. Not only has Alan completely explored her subject from inside and out, she knows the depths, she knows the terms, the golden hour, she knows the actual time frame about everything that's going on. But that last line, children are particularly resilient when submerged in cold water, to me, that's very much part and parcel about this resilient underdog spirit that children seem to have, and it's a miraculous thing.
It's a hauntingly beautiful excerpt, Jamie. Thank you for sharing it with us.
Well, thank you so much, and thank Kate Allen for her genius. So we're going to switch to a different type of trauma done from another absolutely brilliant poet and author. This comes from the National Book Award winning The Absolutely True Diary of a Part-Time Indian by Sherman Alexie. This came out in 2007, and for somebody who loves the pastiche of graphics and writing, and anybody out there who digs that too, Ellen Forney did the illustrations for these, for every chapter, and they sort of flow into the text in a really organic, interesting way that is just so up my alley. But anyway, totally different experience. This is still from a first-person perspective. It involves a young First Nation character, Junior, who is surviving in the weird world of heading off to a predominantly all-white school where he comes to the doorstep of it with a whole lot of baggage, and everybody on the other side has a lot of opinions. But it turns out that he's this kind of amazing basketball player. So in that is a little bit of a consolation that's kind of sad too, that only after displaying these skills is he validated. But anyway, there's a big moment in the book, and there's just these couple paragraphs that I want to read to you, which are incredible. All of these white kids and teachers, who were so suspicious of me when I first arrived, had learned to care about me. Maybe some of them even loved me, and I'd been so suspicious of them. And now I care about a lot of them, and loved a few of them. Penelope came up to me last. She was weeping. Snot ran down her face, and it was still sort of sexy. "I'm so sorry about your sister," she said. I didn't know what to say to her. What do you say to people when they ask you how it feels to lose everything? When every planet in your solar system has exploded. So that's how that chapter ends. When every planet in your solar system has exploded. I think the more we can understand how young people interpret the emotional tidal wave of these events in their lives, that they have no context before. You know, we're lucky if something horrible happens, like a pandemic. Let's use a pretty common example. We have a tool chest, even though it's unprecedented for us, because we're not Benjamin Button or something that survived the Spanish flu or anything like that. But we have a tool chest we can go back to. We can go back to 9/11. We can go back to losing a parent. We have these tools that we've developed. The brilliance of the resilience of children is that they're operating without a guidebook. And I love that. I love that passage from Alexie's book because it's the brutal honesty of what it's like to literally feel like James Dean in the observatory in Rebel Without a Cause when he's watching all the planets collide. You know, I don't want to paint with a huge brush because I can only speak from my teenage experience, but I think that's the way it feels, you know, total dissolution.
And so I'm assuming then that you drew upon these literary inspirations when you were constructing Thomas's character. Did you, Jamie?
I definitely used them as models to reach for sure.
And when you were building Gloomsbury and building the characters that would live within it, did they happen together, or did you create the landscape first and then think of characters that might populate it?
Ooh, that's a great question. That's like, did the lyrics come first or the melody in a song, right? I love all this. Thomas Creeper actually began with a whole nother first line. That first line was, "What do I do with the eyes?" Which I actually really love as a first line. I was submitting some chapters to an agent at the time, and they kind of said pretty much to the effect of, well, that's a little too on the nose to begin with. Once again, this is all about subjectivity, right? You can send 10 things to 10 people and get 10 things back. But at that moment, you know, still being as I am, still young in the industry, though not necessarily young in life, I was said, well, maybe let's not begin with the camera right on the corpse's body and the eyes that need to be closed. I still think you have to grab people from the get-go. And so I remember actually when I heard about the Wonderful Kraken contest, I remember not being able to sleep and getting up probably about 4:30 or 5 in the morning and creeping down to our little guest room with my laptop. And saying, let's try this another way. And so while prologues are not necessarily in vogue in the literary world right now, I wanted to do what I learned from The X-Files, another huge inspiration for me. Those of you who are millennials on the younger side may not remember The X-Files, but one of the tactics that Chris Carter, the creator, used was to give you about a minute or minute 30 second blip at the start of the episode, which would put some of the characters into focus, although the content would still remain blurry. But it would be so grabbing and such a cliffhanger that you already knew more, perhaps, than the two detectives, Mulder and Scully, knew. So there was almost a cheer on your side with that. But that's a technique that I've used before, and I decided to use in Thomas Creeper to introduce the world building from this sort of wide angle lens of the cattails and the swirling marsh and the impenetrable cloud cover. And then suddenly, amidst all of that, you see a couple bubbles in the wine dark sea, and this strange Jules Verne-esque submersible rises, and two characters that you still don't know if they're good guys or bad guys creep out and have a conversation that you are almost a passerby as the reader listening into. So X-Files, I'm just going to tell you, Chris Carter, sorry, I stole it a little bit, but I think I'm not the first person. You know, as Picasso said, when I can steal, I steal.
Well, we would be entirely remiss, Jamie, if we didn't touch upon these gorgeous illustrations that are such an important part of the novel. So I guess my question might really be the same in terms of how the literary work was influenced by the visual work, by the illustrations, and whether one kind of propelled the other or influenced the other, or whether they really were, simply worked upon in conjunction, and the synergy of those two. I'd love to hear you speak more about that.
Well, that's a fantastic question. Thank you so much. I think, just as I said, that the book itself was kind of a love letter to everything I love that was spooky and gothic and gory-esque. What I did with the illustrations was almost a shout out to teens right now, which was basically saying, hey, I was the kid who was 14 or 15 and decided I loved music and writing and illustrating in equal amounts. And I'm going to, God help me, try to do it all. And so what I feel like now, I think as I get to be a bit better of an illustrator and starting to actually read directions about how to use things like Photoshop instead of having the manic, mad scientist kind of a bloom of inspiration and jumping on a drawing pad, which also yields cool results. I just wanted to, with the drawings, say, this is the world I see in my head. This is the world that I inhabit and I love. And I'm going to do 250% even if it's lacking here and there or raw, I want to give you the genuine article from my view. But I also, important thing too, if you actually see the illustrations in the book, I never give you a full view of Thomas's face. And that is an intentional decision. I want the reader to see themselves in that character. It's like once you see something, you can't unsee it, right? So I describe Thomas's features and physiognomy and all that. But you always see there's a book covering his nose, or in the later chapters, it's a shot from behind. I don't know if that's going to change as I illustrate further installments, but I want the reader to see themselves in the character.
They're wonderfully done. They really are. I think they add so much to the book. Can we talk about gadgets for a second?
Yes.
I have to say, you know, I love it. Thomas Creeper definitely has a gothic feel to it. It's a spooky story complete with ghosts and ghouls and all kinds of creatures. But there are also some steampunk elements, I think, to the novel. And we really, when they're on the submarine, we really see a lot of that. And I'm wondering about your inspiration for all those gadgets, because it's clear when you read that they've come sort of from your mind whole cloth. And I wondered if you wanted to speak to that.
Well, thank you so much. You have picked up my breadcrumb trail brilliantly, as usual, Pam Van Dyke. Yes, I love steampunk, but I don't love it like fanboys and cosplayers love it. I'm not denigrating or dissing anybody who needs to dress up with an assortment of leather and goggly stuff, because I do for fun. You know, mostly when my wife's away on business. Just kidding. But no, I love the late 19th century, where you really see this hyperbolic curve where all progress is possible, good or bad, right? We can almost feel an atom bomb at the end of that curve. But in the Belle Epoque and all that period that I love, you can feel just this expansion, which is also done at the expense of so many people. So it's that kind of colored thing. But I love Johnny Depp's character in Sleepy Hollow, what Tim Burton did with the sort of steampunk-esque aspects with him, with his many almost sort of jeweler glasses and all his devices. It's this idea that technology could actually help us, not imprison us in a little, you know, what, a 4x3 little phone. Yeah, so I love that. And so, yes, I poured that into the book. One of my first short stories that have ever been published, which is called Dr. Pax's Great Unsinkable Bird, is about another underdog teenage character who is a Turkish immigrant, a young woman who has been thrust into a very tough situation that ends up giving her a mechanical arm. So, you know, it's like, let's go out on a date. I'm going to put my other arm around you at the movie theaters. This one doesn't have buzzing gears. So I love that being sort of a science neophyte. I wish I was more of a sort of hard science guy. I have such an abiding awe for it. But I learn enough until my brain doesn't work over it. But I love that side of the coin. And I tried to pour that into a lot of the devices that appear in the book. I love the conch whistle, the submarine, is a movable museum of all these devices. And so once again, like I was talking about Hogwarts being its own character, all these spaces where suddenly all the anxiety that Thomas feels about his life goes out the window, or the port side window, and he's basically wrapped up in this incredibly rich, scientific and cerebral and engaging world. And maybe it's just one big fever dream that Thomas dreamt one night. Who knows? I join him in that unbridled awe over what we can do with the right intention, and also a total anxiety and fear over how we use our work. And that's like a tool. A tool can be used for good or bad.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So when I was in middle school and high school, even still, I've always loved horror movies. Always. I'm not sure why. And I'm wondering, what do you think is the ongoing allure of the spooky, especially when it comes to middle grade and young adult readers?
That is a two-part wonderful question, and you will always be in my club of horror fanatics, although I am still the guy with the, you know, glancing through a gap in a couple of fingers because I am terrified by horror, but I'm excited at the same time. I think I'm touching upon the first part, maybe. That's the allure. That's the we all know there's a lot of unexplainable malice and malevolence out there. And when it's personified in something that's you don't expect, that's the magic or the horror, as it were. As far as middle grade readers, that's a good question. I think maybe it jumps off the stuff we've been talking about the world already being kind of spinning out of control. It never slows down to explain really its laws to young people. You have to really dig and ask and put your hand up and interrogate what's going on. But also you're relying on adults to have everything under control, which, you know, I'm not a parent, but I know both of you are parents, and you kind of have to straddle this line between being superhuman and completely vulnerable and not have an answer, particularly right now in this time of bizarre, what I call the new abnormal, which is the pandemic. So I think that the horror intensifies perhaps for beyond just the gore and the comic aspect, which is just so much fun. Army of Darkness and the Evil Dead series is one of my favorite, with the great B actor, Bruce Campbell. You're an A+ to me, buddy. Not that you're listening to this, but I love all the comic-y kind of graphic novel aspects of horror. But I do think now that we're talking about it, that it does branch off of this idea that the rug could be jerked out from under your feet at any moment, you know, economic situation or healthcare pandemic situation. And so I think horror has always been sort of the thing lurking around the corner saying, like, keep your guard up, buddy. You know, you could be next.
I think it also speaks to something you referred to earlier, Jamie, about children being sort of viscerally immersed in their world and perhaps closer to it in many ways than adults who are viewing it through a filter or, you know, through their own adult preoccupations. Children somehow are closer to the reality of things, and they have such powerful imaginative force, you know, that something under the bed or in the closet or the darkness and what it might hide or portend. And I think it's just marvelous to tap into that. You know, the other aspect of your novel that I really enjoy is the ciphers and the fact that the ciphers are included in the work for the reader to decipher just as Thomas is deciphering. I mean, literally at the same time on the same page. And you really sort of feel like you're, you know, there on the bed next to Thomas, sort of figuring out what all these letters mean. I thought that was a really lovely touch.
Well, that's very kind. That's sort of the decoder ring inside the Cracker Jack box that I wanted to give to the readers, because they're taking a huge leap of faith with me. There's so much that's on Instagram right now. There's so much they could be doing that would probably really be calming and interesting and stimulating. And here I am saying, hey, sit down with my 200 odd page book and work out all these ciphers that I've put out there for you. But I think that speaks to a sort of a minority of eager, hungry people who, as I said before in that Stafford quote, the ones with the sharper eyes and the keener hearts. I think those people, regardless of the vicissitudes of our age and time, those people will always be out there, just like every mainstream needs a countercurrent or a little tributary that has more meaning to it, like a lot of what you all are doing with the indie presses. So
now I also want to touch upon your antagonist. I believe that the protagonist or the hero of a work is really only as good as his adversary. I mean, the villain sort of sets up the challenge that that the protagonist has to tackle or overcome or is literally fighting against. And I have to say, your villain is absolutely thoroughly disgusting. And I'd like you to tell us a little bit about the gestation and the character of the bad guy and how that really focused Thomas's particular challenges.
Wow. That is probably the best compliment I've ever received yet from advanced readers. The antagonist is positively disgusting.
Yes, in a super cool way.
That's awesome. No, I mean that. I want him to be disgusting. I want him to be revolting and cringing at just the moment he steps on the page. I think it goes back to the Robert Frost line, no tears in the writer, no tears in the reader. No horror in the writer, no horror in the reader. I had to create somebody that if I just saw his bowler hat, you know, if I was ever able to do this in a film or animation or anything like that, it's sort of the Hitchcock thing of what you don't see, right, is the most terrifying. So for him, it would just be, you know, you're having a pleasant, wonderful moment with friends chatting and a bowler hat just rolls out from the side of a bush or something like that, and or it appears on top of a fence post or something like that. It's the terror that's in the mind, right, that you have to set up. And I know, I mean, like I said, Hitchcock was the master of that suspense. As far as the big baddie, as we will call him, like I said, I had to be terrified of him in my own right. I had to, if he was under my bed or, you know, lurking in my closet, I would pretty much die of fright. The one thing that I would say about him is that, yes, he is kind of pure malice, but he's kind of eloquent, which is scary. If you ever watch my favorite piece of serialized drama, which was True Detective Season 1, you can totally snooze on Season 2, which even the HBO director came out the first time of entertainment and made apology and said, I think I pushed this a little too fast, which is incredible. Like, whatever, you've never heard a head of a company come out and said, maybe. And that was not a smart move. But the first season of True Detective is probably Carrie Joan Fukunaga, I'm not saying it right, the creator, artistic director, has created this backwoods Louisiana world of voodoo and amazing and ways that are just a little more subtle and amazing. And my largest point here, because I could talk about True Detective for days, is that the actual antagonist can quote Shakespeare at the end, you know, or Shakespearean like verse as he's doing things that are so morally reprehensible. So to me, in a very sort of also Cormac McCarthy way with sort of No Country for Old Men, that sort of if there's a Frankenstein that's moving through, you know, our comfortable world out there, and it's a Frankenstein that can do horrible things and also be elegant and eloquent about it, to me, that is the most terrifying thing in the world, because we want something that is, and a villain, I would say, is something that is so on the nose, like, what do I do with the eyes, is so just understandable. Okay, so it's the incomprehensible aspect of a horrifying villain that, to me, raises the hair on the back of my neck.
This is wonderful aspect, too, that you incorporate with your villain, where it becomes apparent that he may have been active or present in Gloomsbury 100 years in the past. And there is a sort of notion that, you know, that he's there as this sort of ever-abiding presence who never ages. And that has a certain horror to it, too, because he develops this feeling that he is undefeatable. And how can a mortician's apprentice, you know, young Thomas, hope to even defeat this all-powerful entity who really does have grandiose plans for really the world far beyond Gloomsbury even, and that just sets up this marvelous dynamic.
Well, thank you so much. I think, as you said, circling back to vulnerability, you know, here is a hero who has so much self-doubt, who has so much baggage. That's where I think the underdog comes through. That spirit of resilience through absolute insanity and adversity. And he has a lot of help. And I think that's sort of the, you know, we could talk about the hero's journey and all those, you know, all those tropes, but he has tricksters, he has allies. That's going to be a big part of what I'm expanding as far as the world of Gloomsbury and this idea of Thomas as sort of a detective for the dead and all the laws of physics that come with that. There's tricksters and allies in his journey. And just as any young person has to decide, what's the model that I want to cling to, or what do I need to repulse? Since we've delved into such dark matters, let's do a little bit of levity here, friends. And I will read from one of the chapters from Gloomsbury Secret. And just so people don't think he's just a guy who just hangs out in moth-eaten robes on urns, and he's gloomy and depressing, and it's far from that. But I like how the comedy and the horror vibe together. So we're going to go with a little bit of comedy here, just to spruce things up. This is a set up the scene. This is Thomas has come to meet Jenny and her pyrotechnically manic younger brother Arnold. All these characters, I'm not going to incriminate myself, are all reflections of J.R. Potter as a young person and his obsessions with jumping jacks and M80s. And it's amazing that Smokey the Bear never showed up on our doorstep. But so anyway, they're all definitely all me. So here we are. We're in Sal's Pizzeria, which we find out in the second book, the sequel, that it's the only restaurant in Gloomsbury that doesn't give people intestinal fireworks. So here we go. Here's the scene with Thomas and Jenny, and pretty much reveals to me how much I love Jenny Myers as a character. Here we go. "I've got it," Jenny suddenly exclaimed. "I bet Pop Mulvaney figured out who these psychos are. He must have discovered something he knew could hurt them. And what if they killed him before he could find it or reveal what he knew to someone else? All I know is these weird guys hanging around and Pop dying can't be a coincidence. Remember that line from Spies, Ciphers, and Poison Capsules? A good spy or detective doesn't believe in coincidence. The only thing I can't figure out about these guys are those swirling tattoos. Are you sure you didn't just hit your head or something?" "Yeah, I'm sure," said Thomas tightly.
"Hey, I believe you, Professor," said Jenny. "Don't go all tweaky on me."
Jenny reached across the table and covered Thomas's hand with her own. They both looked at it for a second before Jenny hastily removed her hand.
"Here's what I figure we need to do," she said. "I say we go..."
Suddenly, a large piece of pizza, dripping with melted cheese, sailed across the room and landed in Jenny's Pepsi, toppling her glass and spilling soda all down the front of her shorts. Thomas's face went white. Jenny's face went red.
"Jenny, don't," Thomas began, but it was too late.
Jenny Myers leapt up from the booth like a cat pouncing on a fleeing mouse. She crossed the room to where her younger brother Arnold sat giggling with several other boys, including, Thomas saw, someone he didn't care to ever see again. Not a ghost. Ghosts he could handle. It was Gary Corvin.
"Listen to me, you freaking dung beetles," Jenny yelled.
"Arnold, get back to your seat." The voice was so powerful, so filled with impressive authority, that even one of the chefs tossing dough behind the counter lost his rhythm, sending the pie a little too high in the air to where it stuck to the underside of the fan whirling overhead. Arnold giggled again, not budging an inch.
"Bad move," thought Thomas, wincing. "Bad move."
Like an insane mama cat, Jenny grabbed Arnold by the collar and swung him up onto his feet.
"Okay, okay," cried Arnold. "Relax."
Now Jenny set her burning sights on her next victim.
"Gary Corvin, I should expect this much from someone who's been kicked off the football team 2 years in a row. The next time you mess with me or my friend Thomas, I'll make sure everyone at school knows I watched your dad spank you over the hood of his BMW last summer." "Spank you, Gary. You got that image? Does everybody have that image firmly planted in their heads?"
Jenny looked around the room at the patrons whose side conversations had been instantly silenced by the unbridled force of Jenny Myers. An old lady in a hairnet, sipping hot lemon tea, made a shocked O with her mouth that looked as if she might have just swallowed an entire lemon. Gary Corvin, who had a word for everything at any time, all of them horrible, was for the first time in his life
rendered utterly speechless. Jenny returned to the table, Arnold trailing behind her, trying to not look like he had just been completely outmatched by his sister. Without missing a beat, Jenny went back to her pizza, while Thomas stared back in awe. "What?" Jenny said after a few bites. "That was kinda raw, Jen," said Thomas, though he couldn't help but crack a smile. Man, was he glad to have Jenny Myers on his side.
Yay! Yes, I'm glad he has Jenny Myers on his side also.
I think we all need Jenny Myers on our side. She just goes back like she hasn't skipped a beat. Are you kidding me? You just dressed down.
It really does encapsulate sort of her gumption and her bravery, doesn't it? I mean, she's just an absolute joy.
She is. She's really one of my favorite characters. And not to give anything too much away, but she actually disappears for a big part of the second book, which is something that puts Thomas even more with his back against the wall, which kind of forces him to own up and create his own voice.
Well, that actually leads perfectly to my final question for you, Jamie. I know that you're working on the sequel, and I wondered if you might give readers a little sort of sneak preview of some delicious tidbit from Thomas Creeper's continuing adventures. Is there anything you can tell us about the work in progress?
Not only can I tell you something about the work, Janie, I can actually read you a super secret sneak peek. Anyway, well, I'll read you the prologue from the book, which doesn't spell out everything completely, but it'll give you my little X-Files sneak peek. This prologue's called Just Give Me Today. Eddie had seen the mask 3 times, maybe 4, though the unyielding dark made it hard to measure any passage of time. The echo of his voice and the wet catch in his lungs told him he was someplace underground, a mine shaft, or an abandoned well. More than once, he had heard the sound of running water. His arms and legs had been tied to the chair with a greasy black rope, thick as his wrist. Though he couldn't see the ground, he knew the chair had been bolted to the floor. Every time he tried rocking himself into a rhythm, the rope would only bite harder into his cold flesh, but the chair wouldn't budge an inch. Alone in the darkness, he would scream himself hoarse, his name, a ragged cry for help. Then the gears would start to churn in the reverberating chasm above his head, followed by the screech of something lowered down, foot by shrieking foot. At first, it looked like nothing more than a halo of flaming light. But as the light came closer, he could see the widening circle, a chandelier, ringed with candles dripping scalding hot wax. When his eyes stopped stinging from the wax and the glare, the masked face would appear by his shoulder, the shimmering metal caught by the candlelight, the dark eyes twinkling behind 2 moon-slivered slats. "Tomorrow, Eddie Jones," the voice behind the mask would whisper, the cruel black eyes never blinking. "Tomorrow." Before he could scream, there would be the prick in his side like the sting of a yellow jacket, followed by the sickening slump out of consciousness. "My name is Eddie Jones," he would repeat over and over again when he came to. Whatever he had been drugged with made his thoughts stretch until they felt thin and diluted, like drops of ink in a giant glass of water. He had to get it right. He had to remember what to say to the police when they found him. "My name is Eddie Jones. I live in apartment 3C at Tide's End Apartments on Wyland Avenue. I am a line cook at Sappy's Diner. My name is Eddie Jones." But this time, awaking from darkness to more darkness, he heard another scream, another voice crying out behind the damp walls. "Por favor, ayúdame, tienes que sacarme de aquí, por favor." The gears churning again, and the scream behind the wall dying to an inaudible nothing. Hours, days, passing. The gears again, almost as loud as the churn of his empty stomach, the chandelier lowering down, illuminating the depth of the slick walls covered with mud and dark furry-looking moss. The light coming closer, blinding him like the sun, but not warm like the sun, not enough to stop the chattering of his teeth. The chandelier stopping, a few feet above his head, the searing wax dripping down, scalding his forehead and eyebrows, his eyes adjusting, away from the pain of the light
to the ground beneath him. Piles of white things all around him. Bones? God, oh God, please, please no. Panic flooding through him. Something moving in the shadows, just beyond the light's radius, too quick to see. His eyes searching the ground again, finally adjusted to the light. Not bones. Shells. A mountain of shells spilling all around him.
You don't have to do this. I'll get you the money. Please, I'll get you anything. Anything you want.
A thin rod, poking out of the darkness, dripping with something. A paintbrush. And the cruel voice, no longer a whisper. Today, Eddie Jones. Just give me today.
I've got the chills.
Once again, you got to do the dark before you get to the light, so.
Bravo.
Thank you.
That's wonderful.
It's very, very Edgar Allan Poe. Certainly entranced and intrigued.
I read middle grade as an editor, but I don't typically pull it off a shelf to read as a book for fun. But I have to say, when I read Thomas Creeper, I found myself smiling. And I was worried. And my husband said, what are you reading? And I said, I'm reading this wonderful book called Thomas Creeper and the Gloomsbury Secret. And so I'm thrilled that we will get to see Thomas again. I'm very, very excited about that. And thank you so much. It's just been a wonderful conversation. Delightful to talk with you and to hear you read from Thomas Creeper and all the selections that you brought to share with us today. So thank you so much, Jamie.
Well, thank you, Pam, and thank you, Janie, for doing all you do to, like I said, curate this wonder for everyone else. I have a firm belief that we are curators and custodians of magic and wonder, and you don't own it. You rent it, right? I feel like I rent it right now with Thomas Creeper, and I want to pass it on to somebody else. And my spiritual intention with this whole series is that if there's some kid who is out there who is at dire straits with his situation or her situation or their situation, that they find something that resonates with them, and that pressure that Thomas feels completely weighing on his chest like a diving bell, that it lifts.
I just wanted to mention too before we leave that Jamie is also a very talented musician and is part of a band, the Crooked Angels. Jamie, is that right?
I am very lucky that I get to share a musical journey with my partner, Amy, and she's an amazing singer and songwriter. And she and I create a collective called the Crooked Angels that involves some of our other ragtag musician friends. And we've just been very lucky to make two wonderful experienced records in Baltimore and send them out to the world like little redheaded stepchildren.
So I must say that you're not going to be allowed on the podcast again unless you give us a little musical interlude. So just be forewarned.
I'm forewarned. I got my guitar right here if you want me to throw something on real quickly right now.
Oh, yes, let's do.
Okay, so this sets it up. I think it tees everything up perfectly because this is a song of mine called I Saw You, which is basically that lightning bolt French experience of coup de foudre, where you fall in love with somebody on sight. And it's a little scary too, because you don't know if they feel the same way. But it also was written as a response to The Girl from Ipanema. If The Girl from Ipanema wasn't just this bubbly caricature of a person, but was like a real woman who has great days and bad days. Thank you, Janie and Pam. And this one's for you. This is called I Saw You.
I saw you standing by the water, blue on blue, sorrow's lonely daughter. I saw you dreaming that tomorrow couldn't be something more than a bad dream. Girl from Ipanema, she's as high as a summer kite. You're low down in blue, but I'm still hoping you might see me the way that I see you. Oh, oh, oh.
Thank you, Horn Man, for coming out. I don't know how you found me. I love you. Can you see it in my eyes? You don't know me. Does it come as a surprise? I want you like the waves cast size, yeah. Is that too much to say? So I'll say I saw you. Yes, I saw you. Well, I saw you. Out of tune, but that wraps it up.
Yay, nice. Wow, what incredibly talented authors and musicians and illustrators we have the privilege of working with, Pam. I'm humbled.
It's so true. We have a real Renaissance man here today. I love it.
One day we'll actually pay the rent, my friends, but right now we're having a whole lot of fun, and that's just as worth it.
There you go.
And what fun we've had this afternoon. Thank you so much, Jamie, for taking the time to be our guest. And for those listening in, Thomas Creeper and the Gloomsbury Secret will be coming out on March the 21st and is currently available for order on our website at www.regalhousepublishing.com. The very best way to support an indie press is to buy books directly from their website, and we are so grateful for your support. If you enjoyed this podcast, you might want to check out our episode with Mary Sullivan, tackling challenging topics in middle grade novels and verse. Thank you for joining us, and from all of us at Regal, keep reading.